Hello and welcome back. I hope you've had a good few weeks. I've had a marvellous time in North Wales as my husband was opening a play up there, which I'll talk about in a minute. Its director, Tamara Harvey, is my guest this week. But before I talk about the incredible Tamara, I'm going to announce that, hooray, I have a sponsor for The Trapdoor, which is a marvellous company called B&Co, a childcare company which is quite quirky and unique in that the people who look after the kids are all actors and writers and creatives who by nature have a rather ad hoc lifestyle. And so they're there to help you with yours if you are like me and you're suddenly going, oh my God, I've got a voiceover or a meeting or a whatever, a casting or a, I don't know, whatever it is, and you suddenly need help the following afternoon, then B&Co is there to save the day. I'm reading now, but B&Co is a unique London members agency specialising in providing families and organisations with excellent childcare from the highest quality creative people. They started off working with children, chaperoning for TV and stage things, and now they just have great fun and lark about with kids for those times that you need a bit of help. They are very generously offering any Trapdoor listener £25 credit if you sign up using the referral code, which is Trapdoor2019. So give them a go. They're really good and they're really lovely, and the whole point is I think you sign up, it's like a membership thing, so you sign up, you become a member, and then they help you with whatever it is, babysitting / saving your life. Anyway, that is the admin over. There will be more information about them in the coming weeks. But back to my stonking guest this week, Tamara Harvey, who is the artistic director of Theatre Clwyd, which is a very well-respected theatre in North Wales, where we've spent the last couple of weeks. Tamara directed Home I'm Darling, which we've talked about now for several weeks. I'm not on the payroll. It is a very good play, and she is a very good director. She is currently directing something which is just opening at the Chocolate Factory called Orpheus Descending, a lesser-known Tennessee Williams play, which is punch-you-in-the-face amazing. I just love it. It's soulful and romantic and just beautiful. So go and see that if you can. Anyway, she came in to talk to me. Oh, so this one was slightly different in that we recorded it in this little cottage we were staying in, and my husband David very kindly offered to cook us dinner while we were recording. But anyone who knows my husband will tell you that he is not a shy, retiring character. In fact, he was pretty noisy in the background. I cut the bit where he was looking up the recipe using Siri in the next room, so you could just hear him going, "Hey Siri," whatever the question was, which obviously I had to stop recording. Quite irritating, also quite funny. So you will hear him, a bit of chopping and bashing in the background, so apologies for that. So Tamara and I were crouched around my equipment in this pretty little cottage on the outskirts of Mould in North Wales, and I asked her first of all whether she'd always wanted to have children.
I never felt strongly either way, and I had friends in both directions. And I think mostly when I thought about it, it was in the context of being irritated when I was in my early 30s, that kind of any time I flirted with a man, you could see almost palpably that or feel that sense of, oh my God, she just wants to make me marry her and then make me give her children. And And I didn't feel that way. And so I just kind of found that all a bit irritating. And I guess also I love my job, and I just couldn't figure out how on earth that would ever work with having kids. And my mum had, so my brother is 6.5 years older than me, because my mum had 6 miscarriages between the two, wow, of us, and then 1 after me.
Gosh.
And so I think also there was kind of a part of me that thought it probably,
yeah,
wouldn't happen anyway.
Yeah.
And then I got married when I was 34. And then I guess a couple of years later, we'd kind of got to the point of talking about it a bit, and kind of went, well, shall we stop trying not to?
Yeah.
And just see what happens. And I think I really did still feel at that stage, it probably won't. And then I'd had 1 miscarriage really early on, and then got the job at Clwyd. And then found out I was pregnant.
Really?
And where we were living in London was 2 minutes, maybe 1.5 minutes walk from my parents and my brother and sister-in-law and niece and nephew. So we had this incredible support network. But I'd got Clwyd in my blood.
That's what you wanted, and you wanted to go for it. And,
yeah.
And also it was presumably, as a being self-employed, there was an attraction of being...
No, yeah. Do you know what? It's really funny. When I got the job, and then when people found out I was pregnant, a number of times people said to me, "Oh, right, that's why you did the job." And anyone who said that has clearly never tried to run a building whilst having small children. I mean, you'd have to be actually insane,
yeah,
to
right,
make that,
yeah,
decision,
yeah.
Because although there is stability in the sense of, you know, there's a steady income.
Yeah.
The demands of being an artistic director are ludicrous.
Yeah.
And particularly the demands, I think, when you first start the job. And when I first started as well, there was no joint chief exec. It was just me kind of leading the organisation.
Right, yeah.
And so I was pretty certain prior to starting that it was an act of absolute idiocy, and very certain subsequently. And so, yeah, it used to drive me nuts when people would say, "Oh, right, that's what you're doing."
So you got the job, then you found out you were pregnant. So not only are you have a new challenge, but you're about to do one of the biggest things in your life in a completely new place and not knowing anyone.
Yeah. I think I was just so determined that it would work.
Yeah, that it did.
That I didn't kind of probably let myself think enough about all the ways in which it might not.
But that's probably why it did work,
yeah,
in a way, because you don't dwell on all the kind of a what ifs or this might not work. You just go, right, it's going to happen.
And yeah, and I think also at the point at which I said yes to the job, that was clear and easy, and I was going to do the job, and then,
yeah,
and then I found out I was pregnant, but then for quite a long while I didn't kind of let myself think that the pregnancy would work,
yeah,
so that, you know, by the time I actually thought, oh no, this seems to be all right, and this baby seems to be staying in there, and
yeah,
it was kind of, I was in it and I was doing it, and a decision was,
yeah,
made,
yeah. I don't know if that's, I remember my mum had, as far as I'm aware, she had 1 miscarriage, so it wasn't the same thing. But she was very much, she would get very cross when people would say, well, once I'm married, I'm going to leave it 1.5 years, and then, yeah, I'm going to have children, and I'm probably going to have, no, not even probably, you know, I'm going to have 3, and da, da, da. And she'd go, you should be so lucky. You know,
yeah,
she was always that really kind of, not superstitious is too strong, but it's, you know, but kind of like...
Well, practical,
yeah,
like
you can't,
realistic.
Yeah, you don't know when and how or if it's going to happen, and you shouldn't kind of tempt fate, really. And so I think because she'd always go on about that in my head, similarly, I just thought it would never happen. But I wonder whether that, you talked about it sort of being a bit ambiguous about children. I wonder if that just comes from a defensive, you know, now,
I'm
having,
sure,
had,
yeah,
children, I feel like, oh, of course I wanted children, you know, this is, I really enjoy being a mother, and it's, and now I sort of think, oh yeah, that's, of course I would like that, that makes sense. But I think pretty much my whole life I've been sort of
Yeah.
You know,
there's a bit of that. And I think there's a bit of as well not wanting to be, just resisting the stereotype as well.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of, well, all women are just desperate to have children. Yeah. And of course, therefore, going, no, not actually. Yeah. And by the way, I also drink pints. Yeah. You know, it's that thing.
And if you do sort of wait till your 30s to have children, there is that you are defined by having them or not having them.
Yeah.
And that's just really, it's much more irritating to be defined by not having them in a weird way. Like,
but also I think if you know, I was 38 when my daughter was born. By that point, you've lived a lot of your life.
Yeah.
Not being a mum and a parent. And so you've got a really clear identity, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah.
In a way that maybe you don't so much if you have them when you're still quite young.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've talked about it quite a few times on this, about the benefits of being old. I mean, in so many ways, emotionally and in terms of your career and being kind of knowing where you are and where, you know, you can afford to take those couple of years, you know, or that maternity leave or that, you know, time out. You know, it's not going to, you know, people think they can't, but they can actually. You can at 38.
Yeah, no, and I think I should have done. I mean, I took a month. It was ridiculous.
Did you take a month?
Yeah.
The first time round?
First time round, I took a month because of where the building was at, really. And where, and all the things that needed to be done, and the fact that I'd just started, and I felt that I desperately needed to convince the board that I wasn't going to be some awful woman who went off and had a baby and, you know, disappeared for however long. And so the first time I took a month, and the second time was because of Oh Mum Darling. The second time I took three months.
Right. And then so obviously we talked to Catherine Parkinson a couple of weeks ago, and she was saying that the idea for Oh Mum Darling actually came before all your children were born.
Before any of them. Yeah. Yeah. When we say it took kind of 6 years from the first workshop to the first kind of nugget of an idea to the first night, they look in horror and you think, no, we're not slow. We've just had a lot of kids and a lot of other things in between.
Yeah. And we were talking a bit about, Catherine was saying that some people had watched it and seen it as it's a metaphor for having children. Did you read any of that into it all?
I think one of the wonderful things about Laura's writing is that people take so many wildly different things from it. You know, we've had people come out and go, oh my God, it's a Brexit play. And people come out and go, so just very different things. And I'm always really wary of saying what I think.
Yeah.
Because I reckon people should be allowed to take what they want from it. For me, though, having said that, because that's a bit of a boring neutral stance, isn't it? For me, it isn't particularly about the mother thing. We were very careful in the making of it that we wanted to be clear that we weren't making a comment on stay-at-home mums.
No.
You know?
No.
So that was really important. But beyond that, I think partly because it was formed mainly before Laura and I had kids, the kind of heart of it was pre that experience.
Yeah, from what I remember of it, I felt that she was kind of surprised by the things she didn't know, you know, so she was suddenly going, oh, hang on, that takes me half a day to clean upstairs or whatever, you know, and so I think that was the thing. And especially, it's especially surprising at 38, or I was 39, almost 40, you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then for something to happen that's quite normal and that, you know, huge amount of people do, to suddenly go, I have no idea how to do that or how I do that in that situation and what I actually think about that. And am I this kind of parent or that kind of parent?
I think that's right. And I think the other thing that is a really interesting parallel is Judy's sense in the play of having disappeared a bit from the world and of the wildly different experiences that she and her husband are having because she's staying at home and he's going out into the world and her sense of that, both of their sense of no longer having common ground to even have a conversation.
It reminds me of a friend of mine who works in TV, and so her work is project based, And she said, I mean, quite in a funny way, not in a... She said to me, she's like, I get on so much better with my husband when I'm working. You know, when I can come home and we can talk about our days. Whereas, like, she goes, I just don't think he... It's really annoying. I think that's got to be unnecessary. I don't know what he's saying. You just hear, like, hammering of a meat, probably. He's something in a make. Anyway, see how long that goes on. But he's a very good cook, so that's good. So you're in a new job and you've had a month off, and how does that then sort of affect your life at home with your baby? And, you know, when you come home at the end of the day, how does that feel? And
I almost don't remember. Right. It was such a bonkers time. I was in the fortunate position where my incredible mum, I mean, she was... there was absolutely a moment when I found out I was pregnant when I thought, I'm just not going to be able to take the job. I'm going to have to, to turn around and say, I'm sorry, I can't do this.
Yeah.
And then my mum said, I will come up to Wales 3 days a week.
Wow.
And I thought, okay, well, if we do that and then we have a nanny the other 2 days, which is kind of just about financially doable, then I think it's okay. And if we make sure that we live somewhere really close to the theatre.
Yeah.
So we found somewhere that's 4 minutes drive from the theatre.
Right.
And the first time around, it was a bit more haphazard, that my mum or the nanny, whoever had my daughter that day, would bring her in, and I'd like see her on every break if I was in rehearsals or like in between meetings. And so I breastfed both.
Wow.
Which was, you know, both something I wanted to do, but actually also a really good, no, I have to see them because I'm breastfeeding. And then with my son, he actually had a room in the theatre, because by then I was just a bit bolder about
it.
So he had an office 2 doors down from mine that the brilliant operations team put a sign on it with his name, and then it said, bilingually, of course, it said trainee theatre maker. So it was just a room with some a changing mat and some toys, and and so I was, that made it possible. I think if I'd been working full days and not seeing the baby for all of that time.
Yeah.
And when I first, I had a month clear, and then when I started back the first time around, I did a bit from home, and then I'd come in for a bit, and then I'd have meetings. So I was I did ask the team to come and have meetings with me at home. So I was, and I'd have her with me a lot. So I would, I directed Much Ado when she was 5 months. So we were casting that when she was like 2-3 months, and I would breastfeed. In fact, an actor came up to me the other day and said, I was the first actor that you breastfed for the first time in my audition.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I guess that's when it started to feel like, 'cause I'm actually by nature, a pretty private person. Mm-hmm. And it was around that time when there was no other option. I needed to breastfeed and I needed to audition, and I was going to have to do the both. And the same thing happened with a board meeting. I just thought, I've got a board meeting, but I've got to breastfeed this child, so I'm going to breastfeed in the board meeting. And I suddenly realised I was in the very privileged position of having a job and therefore not worrying about whether people weren't going to employ me in the immediate future because of being a mum. And therefore probably I had a responsibility to talk about it and to breastfeed in auditions and to breastfeed in board meetings and to talk about those challenges. And so it's something that has continued to feel important to continue to talk about it, but that sits slightly uneasily with my natural impulse, which is not to. But it just feels like all of us have got to start talking about it more, haven't we?
Yeah. Well, I'm really surprised by this, in the sense that I love talking about the the feelings around it all, not the fucking dummies or the not the kind of which sling do you use or any of that. I kind of bristle and hate that kind of conversation. But the whole, like, how do I, and especially in a creative way, you know,
have I lost myself and who am I and who am I now? Because I'm actually different than I were the person I was before. And how do I physically make this work? You know, and I found that really interesting. And then realised there wasn't really many things of people talking about that.
Well, like,
and then people going, oh, I really like that. It's really interesting to hear. Oh, that they went through it too. Well, they felt that too. And you think, and it seems, of course they
did. And it seems
did.
Extraordinary, doesn't it? So I had the same experience when I started tweeting about it.
Yeah.
And people were saying kind of, God, it's so amazing that you're tweeting about the difficulties. And I thought, well, that's good that, but how can it be amazing? How can people not have talked about this before?
Yeah.
But I guess it's only very recently, isn't it, that it's felt as though that were possible without completely destroying any chances of ever being employed again.
Yeah.
I think the thing that I did find difficult, particularly first time around, was people saying, and it still happens a bit, kind of saying, oh, your God, you're so amazing, you know, it's so brilliant that you're managing to do this, and 99% of the time thinking, I'm not.
No,
drowning.
Yeah.
And I think it's a stupid thing to do, to be an artistic director and have kids. And and then feeling like that was an awful thing to say because I should be encouraging women to be able to.
But
actually every time anyone said to me, God, it's so incredible what you're doing, the only thing I wanted to say back was it's stupid.
And why is it stupid?
Because, well, and then when I start talking about this, you realise that kind of so many people feel this way, but because it's completely exhausting.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking the night after I've just opened a show, so the exhaustion levels are particularly
high
at this moment.
Yeah.
But it's exhausting. I feel all of the time as though I am doing a worse job at all of the things, which I know everyone feels, but, you know, I always thought I would be an artistic director who would stay in the office till 10 o'clock at night if that needed to happen and be there cleaning out the cupboard because I, you know, on a Sunday because I'd just muck in.
Yeah.
And I can't be that artistic director.
No.
A lot of the time I walk out of the office at 5 because I have to go and pick them up from nursery and want to go and pick them up from nursery and then, you know, do kind of work later in the evening. But and then at the other end of the scale, excuse me, that was a burp, not sob. And then at the other end of the scale, thinking I just all the time feeling like I'm not a good mum.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true. Not even not a good mum. I think when I'm around, I'm an all right mum. But just not being around.
Yeah.
And they are both amazing kids, like they're just joyous, but so I can't see the immediate damage, but I feel like I'm just waiting for it to hit.
But I don't know, I don't know your situation. My mum worked when I was, and all the way through, my parents split up when I was really young, so she worked, and I remember having, you know, it's around GCSE time, you know, you'd have some debates in class. And I mean, ridiculous in when this would have been, you know, early 90s, a debate about women work, should women work? You know, now you just think, oh, really, you know, awful.
Yeah.
But I went to a private school and most of the girls there, not most probably, the majority, but there were still a lot of working mums there, but the majority's mothers were home, stay-at-home mums. Again, nothing wrong with that. But I remember sort of saying, well, of course it's really, you know, it's a really brilliant example to give your kids, male and female, to have something that they're passionate about and to be putting everything into that. Because that's just, because they are going to have to, unless you make it really big, they're going to have to
do the same.
And so what better than for them to do something that they're driven, whatever that is, driven by the same way that you are. I remember my dad saying to me really young, I was trying to do comedy, and I was like, oh, but you know, it means I've got to, you know, I've got to rehearse in the evenings or whatever, and I hated my job, and I was like, the weekends or whatever, and I was like, oh, my weekends are really important to me. And my dad said, if you want to be someone the rest of your life whose weekends are really important to them, and they, you know, just can't wait till Friday and they're dreading Monday morning, then go ahead. But if you don't, then work weekends and evenings and all that kind of thing. And I was like, probably mid-20s or something, late 20s, and it was such a good bit of advice.
Yeah,
but, you know, that's the thing, and that's, they're seeing that every single day. You don't need to say that to them.
Yeah, and my mum, you know, my mum was a stay-at-home mum till I was 9, and she is the most constant and frequent champion of that. She's the person who most frequently says to me, look at what you're giving them and showing them. There was a total side note, but you just reminded me. My daughter was at the theatre yesterday and saw a poster for Home I'm Darling and said, oh, look, that's Catherine. She lives in my mummy's play.
She does
live in my play.
So once your daughter was born, how did it affect the other relationships around you? So did it, I mean, it will have affected your relationship with your partner.
Yeah.
Were you prepared? Did you know the kind of parents you'd be?
I would take off my hat to anyone who knows the kind of parents they're going to be.
Yeah.
We had got a dog about 3 years previous, so we'd done a bit of parenting of dog.
Well,
which I think is actually kind of weirdly
It's
useful.
Really good. Well, also conversely, we've had a dog after our kids and people are like, oh, it's really full on having a dog. What are you doing? And you're like, it's so much easier than having a child. Are you kidding?
It's amazing. You know,
I can leave it for an hour or two if I need to go out and do something. You know?
But yeah. So I think it's very hard to untangle all the things that were going on because we had moved. My husband's job is primarily in London.
Mm-hmm.
We had moved hundreds of miles away from that. When we came to Wales, he had moved over from LA only 3 years previously when we got married.
Yeah.
So we were now in a place where he knew no one and had no reason for being there except my job. So it was an incredibly difficult time. And oh, and by the way, your mother-in-law is going to be here 3 days a week looking after said child. So I think we survived. I don't think we did it any better than that.
Yeah.
And there were moments that were gorgeous and there were moments that were horrible. I think the really good thing is that we fundamentally most of the time agree on how to do it and have a shared sense of values, which is great.
Yeah.
I think the thing that we battle in ourselves and with each other most is that neither of us want to be stay-at-home parents.
Yeah.
So when there is a period of time where one or other, and more usually him because of the nature of what I do and the nature of what he does, when one or other feels like they are becoming the stay-at-home parent de facto, that's when it's really hard because we, you know, both buck against that.
Yeah.
But it's, I don't know, I was having this conversation with someone just yesterday. If we really knew what it involved, would any of us do it? I mean, we do it twice. So
yes,
you and I have both done it twice.
Yeah.
They are the brilliant bit.
Yes.
And of course, sometimes they're not when they're screaming or when they're pooey or whatever. But you know, they're the really wonderful bit. I think the bit that is really hard is what it does to everything else.
Yeah.
What it does to you know, your relationship with your partner, what it does to your relationship with the rest of the world, with your job, with your, and that's the stuff that I don't think I don't think
I'm prepared for.
I don't think I really thought about. No. And people say to you, don't they? It will change your relationship with your partner completely.
But you think not me?
No, not me.
Not me.
I mean, you guys, really.
Maybe not me. Yeah, yeah. No, exactly. But also, I think I used to get really irritated before when people would say, "You see, when something like Madeleine McCann died, you know, like I've got kids." So I know how awful that is. And you're like, I don't have kids. I also know how awful that is. You know, it's quite irritating, that kind of, you know, that kind of rhetoric. But equally, there is a thing, having had kids, where I do watch something in a different way. And I have changed. And I am much more sensitive. And I'm much more kind of, I mean, I wasn't unempathetic before, but like, you know, those things, it has changed me in that way. It really has. A couple of friends who are kind of, you know, my age, early 40s, kind of not necessarily, you know, certainly not defined by wanting to or not wanting to have children, but kind of at that point where they're like, yeah, maybe, maybe not. And I sort of feel like, and this is awful. This is probably the worst thing to say. But I kind of want to tell them a secret, which is I was like that too. And actually, I wouldn't change it for the world. Even with all those things that you've said and that, you know, feeling of loss, a huge sort of wave of domesticity that's kind of like just blanket, like a heavy blanket that's just fallen on top of my head, you know, all that kind of thing. But yeah, I would not change it for the world. And you can't communicate that to someone as well as the stuff that changes.
No, and if you try, you become all the people who are really bloody irritating before you had kids. You know, all those people who say, oh, it's just, you can't understand it until again. You just want to punch them in the face. Yeah. So you
dare
try. And
also people who would say, they'd say things like, I used to get really irritated, but they'd say, you will feel, this will be, like, you don't know how I'm going to feel.
Yeah, exactly.
Or how it's going to, you know, what it's going to be, annoyingly.
That thin skin thing is fascinating, isn't it? And I think that's one of the things that's made the job tougher, is I think it just kind of peels away quite a lot of the armour that you have built up over, you know, your life thus far. And partly that's sleep deprivation, you know, definitely I'm closer to tears because I'm just so tired. But it's also to do with, I guess, that massive cracking open of your heart that they do. And that makes watching films and TV kind of joyously more emotional.
Yeah.
But it makes being in the workplace and dealing with challenging situations much more difficult, I think.
Yeah. So in terms of, I mean, obviously you were living in London before you had children. What are the, I mean, obviously you haven't had children in London, so you don't, but you know, how has that, you were a city dweller and you moved to the country. Have there been kind of positive aspects of that or frustrating aspects of that? Or?
Yeah, both. I had a bit of a sense of what having children in London might be like because I lived right around the corner from my brother and sister-in-law, and they I spent quite a lot of time with particularly my niece and nephew, and I've just had a bit of an experience of it because rehearsing Home I'm Darling, we kind of all relocated and experienced that. There are the obvious brilliant things, like, you know, outside the kids' bedroom window is a field and sheep, and the air is extraordinary and it is beautiful and breathtaking, all of those things. I love that she's learning Welsh. I love that this bit isn't to do with city or countryside, is it, but I love that they both kind of run up and down inside the theatre and think that that's just, you know, life.
Well, no, but I guess that maybe you're, I mean, actually my kids see that.
I was about to say
maybe if you were in London, I'm like, hang on a second.
No, your kids. No. I've seen your kids doing that. Your kids do that in anyone's theatre.
Yeah, they do.
They
actually
did it in Glowing. But I think the thing I didn't really anticipate, again, not to do with city or countryside, but to do maybe with moving hundreds of miles away from where you've been, is that my friends who were my support network in London and had been for years, very few of them really know my kids, and that breaks my heart. You know, like my best friend in the first 2 years of my daughter's life, she met her 3 times because it's just a long way and you're not going to travel, and and if your friends also have kids, they're not going to travel. So that's the bit I hadn't anticipated, and I hadn't anticipated quite how much that would quite how heartbreaking that would be. And then the other thing that is a kind of practical thing that I find difficult is how car based our lives are here. You know, with my niece and nephew, all my memories of them are of pushing them up and down the Woolworth Road in a pram and getting on buses and all of that jazz. And here, our children spend far too much time in car seats. And don't really walk as much as I would love them to. You know, I'm trying to get better at just going, we're at home, we're going to go out for a 30 minute, we're just going to walk out into the village. But we don't do it because when it's not, you're never walking for a purpose in the countryside. It's so weird.
Yeah, it's so weird. I heard that recently, actually. City kids bonkers. Move more. Isn't that weird? But then in sort of terrible air, like polluted, you know.
I guess, but I just can't believe how little I walk. And I've moved to the country. Absurd. So that's
your kids are very wee, though. Like, I mean, I say that.
They're 3 and 1.
Our eldests are 3 weeks apart. Same age. Yeah, pretty much, aren't they? Yeah. But that your younger, but then, you know, we went for a walk with the kids on our first day here, which was lovely. Half an hour. And it's, you know, with 2 toddlers.
It is tough.
That's quite hard.
But even, you know, I guess even the act of being walked, like my existence with my niece was a pushchair existence.
We rarely use
a pushchair because you get in the car and you get out and then you go, you know, you're in a place or so that's really weird.
I made a long car.
Yeah, it is difficult to be honest about this stuff.
I just found myself twisting into 7 different kinds of knots and wrapping my arms around my legs and, you know, just with the effort of going, no, be completely straight.
Yeah.
Because every which way you feel like you're betraying someone or something. It's extraordinary.
Well, yes, because it is, I mean, it's the most profoundly personal thing, isn't it? Because it's who you are. I remember someone saying to me when I worked at the BBC, well, I was probably early, mid-30s, and he said, oh, yeah, well, you've decided... I wasn't even doing that well. And he was like, well, you've decided to put your career ahead of having children or whatever. And I was like, no, I haven't. Like, I haven't. I haven't made that decision. I've just... had some shitty relationships and I haven't met someone I want to have kids with yet. Do you know what I mean? It's much simpler than that. And you're kind of attributing me with some kind of, like, I have some kind of grand master plan and I don't, and I'm just, and still now it's just, I'm just chasing my tail.
And isn't it fascinating that also that would be a negative if I had done that?
Yes. Oh, totally.
Or even that is something I would have to do.
That I would have to choose between the two things.
Yeah, exactly.
And you say that thing when you hit 30 and then suddenly sort of men are seeing you in a different way. I remember hearing a guy that a friend got together with, and we were in our 20s, and I remember him saying, and he was a bit older, so he was in his mid-30s and she was probably late 20s, and he said, I'd never go for a woman in her 30s because all they want to do is settle down and have kids. And that sort of circled through my head in my 30s. I'm just thinking, no, you disgusting, horrible human being. You know, that's not the case.
Yeah.
And also, Oh, I mean,
and also, whatever. Even when it is the case, it's the case because it has to be for us.
Yes, so exactly, exactly. And we can't do anything about it. Exactly, exactly. How has being a parent changed your... Because obviously your mum's helping with looking after your kids. That must have make your...
She did that for the first year. And now they're both... my daughter's in nursery full time.
Right.
Guilt, guilt, guilt.
Yay.
Terrible parent. And my son is in nursery part-time, and then we have a part-time nanny.
Right.
I even hate that word.
I hate
even
that word.
Word makes me feel like
I never, ever use that word.
I don't know what else to use.
I always say, because the person / people who look after our kids are, in my head, are part of our family, I can't, so I say things like, oh, the person who looks after our kids.
Yeah, no, that's what I do. If I'm introducing her, so I go, this is so and so who looks after our kids.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. But that kind of, it's like, why can't I just say?
Because I can't be someone who has a nanny.
No,
because
I
think that's partly for me a class thing.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I got bullied to hell for being posh when I was a kid. So I can't be. That's like a confirmation of posh.
Yes.
And also because that goes privilege and that goes bad mum, that goes choosing career. That's Mrs. Banks. I'm just Mrs. Banks, aren't I?
Well, though she was great. She was a suffragette.
She was a suffragette, but she didn't have dinner with the kids, did she?
No. But it was, you know, turn of the last century. You know, come on. But yeah, so how has that affected your relationship with your mum? Has it made you sort of look back on things in your childhood and go, oh, you were right, why, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've had a pretty brilliant relationship with my mum for most of my life. I think there was a year when I was around 9 or 10 when I was a complete tit and she was enduring it, but so I've been lucky in that way. It's definitely, I would say it's definitely made us even closer.
Yeah,
because we partly, because we've kind of spent more time and partly because she's just so incredible with them. And I would say that kind of the best bits of me as a mum definitely come from the way she parented me, but also from the way I see her parenting my kids now.
So are there things that you... Do you think there are things that she's now... Because she's, like, she's co-parenting in a way with you and Jack.
Yeah, I was,
with
yeah.
you and your partner. But do you see things that she does that you think, oh, maybe she didn't do that with you, but that's a neat trick, or...
Yeah,
She must be different, maybe.
Yeah, she's certainly, I would say, more relaxed.
Yeah, yeah.
That's probably true of all grandparents. I think it's a very different experience, thus far, because we were abroad when I was... the age that my kids are now.
Right.
So we were in Africa, we were in, well, Zambia when my brother was born, Botswana when I was born, and then we were in Massachusetts for a couple of years.
Oh, right.
And so I think I hadn't thought of this before, in a not dissimilar way to me.
She's displaced.
She was in a place where she knew no one, but she was the person who was there because of her partner's job. So a different thing there.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the way she parented maybe came from, in part from that, in part from being somewhere other. And also she has a degree in education psychology, so she's also just bloody good at it.
And there's that. Yeah.
I mean, I spend my whole life thinking if I can be a tenth of the mum my mum is, then I'll be doing an all right job.
That's lovely.
Yeah, she's incredible.
In terms of you were talking before about the guilt. How do you process that? How do you work through it?
I'm not sure I do. Weirdly through tweeting in part.
Right.
I was never, I mean, I was late to Twitter and didn't really understand it. And then I just, there was a day at a bus stop when I had... I'd managed to get, it was when we were rehearsing Home, Mum, Darling, and I'd managed to get me and both kids out of the house, and I'd got my daughter to nursery, and I'd got my son in the sling. He was at this point 3 months old, and we were all, you know, I'd got out of the house. I was dressed. He was dressed. We were at the bus stop. I was going to get to rehearsals on time, and that all felt pretty miraculous. And I was having a real moment of, look at me, I'm rocking it.
Yeah.
And then this grey-haired gent at the bus stop looked at me and looked at my son, who didn't have any socks on at that point because he got quite clammy feet, so I hadn't put them on. And this bloke said, "Cold feet, poor boy." And I was so furious. And of course, I said nothing. I smiled and went, "No, I think he's fine. I think it's fine. He's gone." And so I tweeted it, which was not something I would ever think about doing or had thought about doing previously. And there was this kind of outpouring of people going, "Oh my God, yeah, I hate it when other people parent." And it started this kind of dialogue, I guess, which is still going. And that is. I think if I was, I think probably what I should do is have therapy, and that would be brilliant because everyone I know who has therapy says it's brilliant, but I've never managed to do it, and I suspect I won't in the immediate. But I guess it's a very tiny version of that.
Yeah.
When I'm at my most desperate or feel most guilty, I channel that into trying to write a concise and ideally witty tweet about how desperately hard it all is.
Yeah, I think I do the same with Facebook, actually.
Yeah.
I'm too scared of Twitter because it's like the Wild West. I'm just like, anyone could read it and be mean to me. But yeah, no, it's quite a good way of also of just organising your thoughts, I think, sometimes when it just feels like you've left the house and you feel like this brilliant human being, and then someone just slaps you down like that, and it's such a
and you've got nowhere to put that
really shitty feeling, and it's, you know, and it feels cliched in a way because people talk about those things, and you know, you see those things depicted on TV before you have had kids and stuff, and you just think, you know, but it really gets to you.
Well, and interestingly, I've only had it once. Someone quite recently sent a reply to a tweet that I sent saying, "You're not a single mum." I think it was kind of, "Unless you're a single mum and trying to do this whilst also trying to manage a career on two continents or something, then count yourself lucky," or something like that. And even that was useful because actually it didn't make me think, "Oh, you're right, I've got nothing to complain about."
No.
It made me think, I am fully aware of how many benefits I have and how very fortunate I am. I think it's still okay to stand up and say, "This is hard."
Yeah.
And you know, we're never relative in our emotions, are we?
But I mean, it's not human. Of course we're not. I mean, that would be not human.
But so that was kind of quite useful as well because it just made me think, "Oh no, I shouldn't be." And then I thought, "No, bluff, sod it, absolutely."
Yes, absolutely. And also, as you say, people don't talk enough about. I'm saying this in a gendered way, but like obviously there are like loads of couples who do things in a different way, but largely, you know, men have come a long way, like compared to my dear father, 70s, 80s father, who, you know, just barely changed. I mean, he's four kids. I'm not sure if he ever changed a nappy and certainly wouldn't wake up in the night with the kids or be, you know. And yet my brother, who is, you know, 40, has done all of that with his kids and sung them to sleep and, you know, and done all of that. So there's a huge change, I think, probably even more so between men of those generations than women. But still, there's just this huge difference that just still doesn't seem to be recognised in just that, just the fact that for you to get to work, you have to climb 8 mountains.
Yeah.
And largely, and this is, I don't mean this, I'm talking about the main carer versus the, you know, or the person who's, you know, that the other person. person can leave and say goodbye and go to work, it's safe in the knowledge that the kids are in the best possible hands. Whereas, especially early on for me, and I have a very different and very charmed existence compared to having to work full-time and all that kind of thing. You know, I'm just popping off to a voiceover or something for a couple of hours. But, you know, a few times early on, just leaving my baby with someone I didn't know and had not met until they turned up at my door.
Yeah.
You know, and that was really hard.
And it's a physical pain. That's the thing I found fascinating. There were a couple of times when I was in a meeting and was late because I wasn't brave enough to say I have to leave now.
Yeah.
And driving her, there was one time in particular when I was driving the only 4 minutes, it's a 4 minute drive from the theatre to home, and just wailing.
Yeah.
Even though I was about to see them, but wailing at the kind of physical pain of feeling like I have to be with them and I'm not.
Yeah.
And I find it interesting that even my colleagues who have kids, and I am going to be a bit gendered here, mainly my male colleagues who have kids, if I am walking out the building saying, I have to go now, otherwise I won't be there for bedtime, or I have to go now because I have to be back in 40 minutes, so I only have this window, will still be asking me questions and stopping me as I'm going out the door. In a way that I don't think the women do. The women say go.
Yeah. And is that mothers say go or just women?
That's a really interesting question. Mothers for sure.
Yeah.
But actually, no,
I think women do. I think women, I mean, my mum used to say, her whole world centred around the tube and public transport. She says things like, she's wearing, you know, everyone's wearing that on the tube, as if it was like the place. I don't know. But I sort of feel like that about public transport as well. And for me, the microcosm of it is the bus. And and women are just always kind and generous in terms of you holding babies and buggies and whatever it is. Women tend to kind of box and cox and kind of work together and less so. I mean, that's a huge generalization.
It's always so difficult, isn't it? Because actually these are important things to talk about, and yet in talking about them we instantly hit up against generalizations and stereotypes and not wanting to.
But the thing is also, no, I'm going to actually stick my neck out because I had two pregnancies back to back. I had 4 months where I wasn't pregnant. I have no idea. Anyway, but so there was, you know, and I live in London and I don't live in Covent Garden. So, you know, there's a lot of buses and tubes and, you know what I mean? So, and no, it is. It's women always. I mean, 95% of the time, the person who gives you their seat is an elderly woman. Do you know what I mean? When you're pregnant and whatever. And what happens, there was recently a distant colleague who made the point, she's disabled, and she made the point, actually, I don't care, you know, don't be offended because you think maybe I'm okay. You know, you sort of think, oh, I don't want to give that person my seat because they might be pregnant. They might be fat, not pregnant. They might be not disabled. They might, you know, he might be, take it as a slight of his masculinity, even though he's elderly, blah, 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 all this kind of thing. It's like, do you know what? Let's just forget that. Let's just look up. She's like, look up. And the thing is, I guess the majority of people on a tube train
just don't look up.
The people who are really always looking down are guys on like a, that's a massive generalization, but like playing games or whatever on a phone. Maybe women are less so. Maybe they, I don't know, whatever. Okay, we're going too far down generalization. But the point is that you just need to look up. It doesn't matter.
It's a great phrase, isn't it?
Brilliant. What advice would you give to somebody who is just a budding artistic director, theatrical director, about to have their first child? What would you say?
What would I say? I would say, take more time than I did.
Really, would you?
Yeah. And then I would know, and then they would probably ignore it because people said that to me. Yeah. And I thought, yeah, no, I'm fine. I'll be fine. But it turns out the building will probably stay standing, and but your children will stop being babies and you won't have been there. So take more time. Know that it's all right, that you will feel like you're getting almost all of it wrong almost all of the time, but that if there are moments still that make your heart sore, whether that's a moment with your child or a moment in the rehearsal room or a moment in someone else's rehearsal room as an artistic director who's programmed it, then it's probably okay. And I guess I think the other thing I would say that I haven't done yet but that has carried me through is know that it's okay to stop if you need to.
Yeah.
You've chosen to do this thing. You've chosen to be a director or an artistic director who's having a kid. And if you get, you know, a month or 2 months or 3 months into that and think, I can't do this, then that's okay.
Did you give yourself that permission in your head?
No, I don't think I did, really. I didn't. And the final thing, I guess, is find the people who will make it okay.
Yeah.
So, like, I am incredibly fortunate in that my joint chief exec is both a brilliant colleague and also always the person who will, even if we're fighting seven different fires, say, go home, do bedtime, right, yeah. I'll talk to you afterwards.
Yeah, right, yeah.
So find the people who will make it okay.
Yeah. Thank you so much to Mara Harvey for talking to me. It was one of those conversations where I think listening back to it a few times and editing it, I realised I talked way too much because so much of what she said really chimed with me. And even listening back to it, I kept thinking, oh, that's really true. Oh, I didn't, you know, anyway, she's great. And as I say, if you want to go and see her properly amazing work, go and see Orpheus Descending at the Chocolate Factory. It's on now. Next week, I will be talking to Marcus Brigstock. He doesn't need much introduction. He is a brilliant and funny and clever comedian and man. So tune in for that. And I hope you have a good couple of weeks. My husband David has told me not to say see you next week because this is a fortnightly podcast. So see you in a fortnight. Or for the loyal fans, see you next week.